You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hello, Nikita.
Hey, Bob, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. Let me introduce this. I'm Robert Wright, publisher of Non-Zero Newsletter. This is the Non-Zero Podcast. You're Nikita Petrov, proprietor of the Psychopolitica newsletter, member of the Non-Zero team. We should start with local news quickly. As of a few hours ago, I'm a grandfather. And,
congrats.
Yep. Thank you for the applause. You can now take your seats again. Thank you. right after this podcast, my wife and I are driving into the big city to actually see the baby. I think it won't feel real until I hold her in my arms, or at least see her in person. Although I've seen, you know, seen pictures, predictably cute, you know, which is, it's odd because I'm sure you've seen pictures of babies of this age, Nikita. Almost without fail, they are ugly as shit. And now, all of a sudden, this cute one, it's like, what were the chances, right? I just feel so blessed. I caught a
glimpse of you talking to your family about it, and the formulations were very interesting. On the ugly to cute spectrum, she's trending towards the less ugly part.
Well, I'm always a straight shooter with my family. You know, I mean, let's face it, none of them look good at this age. Let's be honest, even when they're related to you. Okay, so today we got a lot to do. We're going to go from the mundane to the cosmic. Going to start with a very important, I think, Iran war update. I mean, things are still in flux, but some important stuff has happened. A Russia-Ukraine war update. You're telling us there's a vibe shift, and I genuinely don't know what it is because I've heard conflicting reports on what about vibe shifts from the two mm-hmm. sides. So I'm on the edge of my seat. Then we are going to, via a segue that actually connects this stuff to what follows, we're going to talk about the movie The Matrix, AI. Did The Matrix kind of get it right? Was it prescient when it came out, these many years ago, 27 years ago? And various other, various interpretations of The Matrix and cosmic speculation that's Matrix related that you, what's that?
I was just saying, I'm going to try smuggling some psychedelics and esoteric thought and Gnosticism and weirder. Shit.
Yeah, you're in charge of the weirder ideas. In this crazy world, who knows? I mean, I'm entertaining some pretty weird ideas about AI and stuff. And I think, you know, The Matrix, you can laugh. You can laugh. I'll see you in the gooey pods. Iran update. Feel free to interrupt with questions, Nikita. Not that I will necessarily have the answers, but quick review. One thing this war revealed is that Iran can, in effect, control the Strait of Hormuz. In fact, it's easier than we had realized because I think we hadn't really counted on drones. In olden times, you used to have to mine the strait. Pretty complicated. Now they can just, you know, threaten to hit a tanker with a drone and the insurance companies are like, no way, and you're done. The strait is closed. The drones can be fired from a long way away. So it's not like just for the U.S. Navy to suppress fire along the shore would be enough. During the ceasefire, it looked like the strait was going to open up because as part of a move toward diplomacy. So the U.S. had, first of all, decided to retaliate against the closure of traffic, which was selective, right? Iran was saying, hey, if we like you and you give us a couple $1 million, we'll let your boat through. That's about $1 a barrel of oil. That's not really a lot of money in the scheme of things. And, you know, if you resume to that level and they let the traffic flow freely, that would be a huge relief for the world economy. But the U.S. doesn't seem to want to entertain that possibility. They just don't want to leave Iran in control. So first of all, when the U.S. imposed a counter kind of blockade, which basically meant we're going to not let even the ships that Iran wants to let through, especially including the ones that come from, well, namely the ones that come from Iranian ports. So we're going to try to, you know, kind of to the extent that we can shut down their economy. No boats coming or going to the ports themselves, at least. And so that was the situation. And that was originally the idea, I think, of Richard Haass, former president of Council on Foreign Relations. I think he was the first one to broach it, which makes sense because it's a classic blob idea. And being president of CFR is like being Pope of the blob, as Andrew Sullivan put it once. I think, you know, it shows no real thought about what's going on the other side. If you thought that was going to work and Iran was going to cave, some people still think they'll cave if you keep that blockade long enough, on long enough. In any event, okay, so the latest development, you've got that situation, kind of mutual blockades, although Iran is seeming to sneak some stuff out, but still, they're not liking it. But Trump gets impatient, apparently, and in a classic kind of jumbled messaging Trump exercise, he starts out a couple of days ago saying, okay, we're going to guide tankers through the strait. Everybody thought that meant like escort with, you know, military ships, right? And then CENTCOM puts out a statement saying, we don't mean escort, we mean guide, like, you know, on the phone or something. Say, okay, you're doing great, you know, like. And the first thing I thought is, wait, you can't do that alone. Iran knows where the mines are. You can't, I mean, leaving aside the, you know, the, so I thought, well, this must involve Iranian coordination. And some people took it as good sign. Like, oh, we have U.S. Iranian cooperation. Wrong. So, but then the next thing you know, the military, having said it's not about escorting, says, okay, we got two destroyers, missile-guided guided missile destroyers or whatever, as I understand it, through the strait into the Gulf. And as a result, two tankers have come out, or some number of tankers have come out or something. And I'm like, wait, you think Iran's not going to do anything? Like, you know, and then you did start hearing about report. I mean, this is, it's been so clear. Everyone actually knows anything about Iran has been saying for weeks, Iran decided, I mean, for more than a month, Iran decided early in the war, once they realized that they, you know, can secure, well, maybe they already knew, but they're not going to let go of the strait. This is going to be, they want it as a long-term source of revenue, as a kind of toll gate. Doesn't mean they're going to constrict traffic much, but they're not going to let go of control. But so, and sure enough, then you hear, well, Iran did fire on these naval ships, and they did fire on and hit a couple of tankers. And, you know, actually, they went further and they hit a facility in UAE that, which is, UAE has now become the arch enemy of Iran in all this. I mean, more than ever, in a way, is the country toward which there's the most, with which there's the most mutual hostility, for reasons I could get into. But they had an oil facility that was helping them get around the Iranian control of the strait, because it was on the other side of the strait, I think. And it was a terminal, and Iran hit that. So they attacked UAE. And as of a few hours ago, I was thinking, well, okay, Iran won this round, because what it looked like, Trump was saying, well, and Hegseth, well, what Iran did isn't, that's not above the threshold of restarting the war. It's still a ceasefire. Mm-hmm. And basically, implicitly, seemed to me they're saying, okay, we give up. We ain't sending any more ships. This didn't work, because there's no tankers that are going to try this anyway now. So didn't work, and
but the tankers that did try to go through did go through, and the American ships, even though they were attacked, didn't suffer serious damage.
Is that right? And the other thing Americans could say, if they wanted to claim they won this round, which is bullshit, as I'll explain, but if they wanted to, they could say, they say they destroyed six of these fast boats that the Iranian Navy uses. They're basically glorified motorboats. Four or five people on board. If they really totally destroyed them all, that would have been killing like maybe 30 Iranians. And they could say, you know, we intercepted all the cruise missiles sent at our ships, at our military ships. The Navy could say that. And we killed 30 of them. We didn't lose any people. They lost 30. We win. Mm-hmm. You could say that, but the fact is, I think this is what's called escalation dominance being demonstrated by Iran, not for the first time. Escalation dominance, as I understand it, basically means you get the last word, okay? The other side does something, and you do something that is a little, in some sense, beyond what they did, that says, like, if you keep this up, we'll not only, you know, as they say in poker, see you, but raise you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Iran said, look, we're not going to just do the minimum we have to do to make this a failed effort on your part, which would be hitting the two tankers. You hit the two tankers and it's over. Because no, again, no tankers, more tankers are going to try that. No insurance companies, you know, it's pretty much over. You've done it. You said this didn't work. But they went further. They attacked UAE. I didn't expect that. And they attacked the ships. So basically, Iran said, look, you try shit like, remember, Iran considers the U.S. blockade itself an act of war and a violation of the ceasefire. And anybody could have told you, if we try to actually send, first of all, if we say, we'll guide you by telephone, they're going to hit the tankers coming through. And if we send ships in, they're going to minimum hit the tankers and maybe attack the ships. Turns out they're going to do more than that. And anybody could have told you this wasn't going to work. These people are idiots. And for Richard Haass to have originally thought the blockade was going to work, in fact, he backtracked, didn't admit it, but a week or two ago, he said, yeah, I think we should end the blockade, accept what Iran is offering now. And sure, that may mean that Iran offers a toll, small price to pay for peace. But wait a second, Richard, the whole idea of your blockade idea was to end the toll. The whole clear idea was that we do the blockade, and Iran would say, okay, you're right, we can't control Strait of Hormuz. And then Haass sees what a dumb idea he had once it's in action and says, okay, yeah, what we should do is this, but doesn't, the part I heard of his little podcast didn't even admit that he was admitting it failed. It's just, the blob is a wonderful thing.
So I wanted to ask about the ramifications of the...
Let me just add one thing. Right before we came on, I saw a report that UAE is reporting incoming missiles. So I thought this whole thing was over because it sounded like U.S. definitely backing down. No new news today. And it's getting late over there, right? It's like late afternoon or something. But now all bets are off. If Iran is... But frankly, I'm not exactly sure what they're up to if they're attacking UAE again. It's possible that the U.S. did something they consider a provocation. It's possible that they're just like, I want to really drive this point home. We're in charge. And we're not afraid of war. And that's the other thing that the U.S. has to process. They are less, in a way, less afraid of an ongoing war than the U.S. is. Not more afraid than Israel is, and that's what I think Iran should worry about. But Israel would love to get the green light from Trump at this point to do some more bombing. Anyway, okay, so go ahead.
So I wanted to ask about the ramifications of this. So this is like this week's events, and there's going to be push and pull, escalation, de-escalation for some time to come. Do you have a sense of the long-term safety of the regime in Iran? Like, there have been these rounds of assassinations of the top leadership. Where is that headed? Is it? Because I've heard, on the one hand, the proclamations that the regime actually became more solidified and more militant, and on the other, you know, you can only survive successfully, like in succession, killings of the top elite a certain amount of time. At some point, you just don't have enough people willing to step up into the role where their 10 predecessors died. So that is one question. How do you think strong the regime is, and what is its, how long can it last under these circumstances? And on the other end, how is it playing for Trump at home? Is he being emboldened, or the other way around? Is he going to try to wrap this up?
The domestic politics don't look good for him. If you look at the approval rating, you know, right. He got a little bit of a reprieve from the assassination attempt. didn't last long. So yeah, his numbers are pretty much at an all-time low for this term. Not quite to pre-assassination levels, but it ain't playing well. Gas prices are still going up. And in a way, it's just hitting. It's just becoming real because it's people look at the oil futures market, but there's also the spot market, which is what people are actually paying for oil right now. And that apparently is super high. And that's only just now hitting home because it's only been like a week or two that, you know, these things take so long to get here from Iran that they were still arriving. Oil was still arriving from Iran like 6 weeks into the war. And it's only now starting to hit home, and gas prices have gone up, you know, well over a dollar where I am. They're going to start clearing $5 in a lot of places. He doesn't have, and there are all these other bad effects, but gas is the most immediately and clearly attachable to this war. I'm sure the Republicans in Congress are saying, wrap this shit up. We've got midterm elections. There's that. On the Iranian regime, I think, first of all, there's a round of, so far as I can tell from listening to the Iran experts I trust, both, you know, Iranian and non-Iranian, but experts on Iran that I trust. There was this bit about, oh, the regime is so divided. We didn't know who wants what. That was like 100% fake news, I think. And it was even, you know, and it was successful fake news. One of the big papers, the Journal or the Times, maybe both, reported it like big front page, sort of like regime divided. I think that was just almost 100% fake news. And I think it's not a divided regime. Now, does it have something to fear, like the assassinations and stuff? I'd be worried about going back to war for that very reason if I were them, because the assassinations were continuing at a fairly frequent rate when the ceasefire happened. I think there had been one within the last week, and they were always non-trivial people. I mean, they're running out of, you know, top people to kill unless they kill the replacements, which they may be able to do. But at the same time, what you hear is from the experts, Iran, this government is designed to be resilient. And I mean, it is in the first place by its institutional nature, but then after the June war, they doubled down on designing it for resilience. You know, it's like, first of all, it's kind of decentralized in the sense that there's a number of people who can make important decisions, number of job descriptions. And then each job, there's like an understudy and maybe an understudy's understudy. They're just like ready to step in, from what I understand. And one thing about the ceasefire is it's given all the new occupants of the roles time to really get their roots in, right? And the new understudies to spend a couple of weeks. So I would think, and I would assume that they did whatever they could to figure out how the hell Israel keeps finding out how to kill people. High-ranking people, you know, but it must be a tough job because it's probably a combination of informants and technical stuff. But I'd be worried, you know, but as they say, these are harder liners than the people we killed. We keep killing the closest thing to a moderate that's left, and Israel wants that, I think, and Trump is too stupid to understand that he shouldn't want it and that it's happening, and that it's happening because Israel's doing the assassinating and they want it to happen. But this regime, I mean, I do think, you know, I'm generally skeptical of claims that any regime almost is driven fundamentally by this ideological fervor to the extent of not becoming rational actors. Because most regimes really do fundamentally act like rational actors. When they don't, it's because of domestic political constraints. And even this regime, as a, you know, like this last thing, very effective escalation dominance. They've done it before. It's impressive. It's an aggressive way of playing a game in accordance with game theory logic. Now, this latest thing, if they're hitting UAA again, I'll need to hear like what the logic is, if anyone has an idea. But that said, I do think maybe there is more actual ideological fervor in this regime than there was in the old one. And so that's what regime change can get you. And that may be why Trump has an even bigger problem than he thought, because to the extent that they don't fear war, they're going to take a tough line at the bargaining table. I think if Trump just understood the situation, which he's miles from doing, but if he did, or somebody else with influence in the administration did, there would still be a way to get what we consider the fundamentals, which is like get the nuclear program under control. That's supposedly the most important thing. And we could even do it in a way that brought more stability to the Middle East, which is actually what Iran wants. They don't want any near-term wars. But you better hurry, because it's harder with this regime than the old one. And I don't think it's getting easier. And we'll see. These people are beyond incompetent. And Trump is, is stupid and borderline mentally ill. And I say those things advisedly. I'm not kidding. He's like, this is a problem, you know, and he's emotionally unstable. And we have a real problem. Anyway, that's the
update. Don't think that it's feasible that, like, the strategy of just killing the top command every once in a while and having a deal on the table that at some point some successor can take along the lines of what you just described, getting the nuclear arms under control and establishing some stability in the region. Do you think this is not a feasible strategy, or is that not a strategy that the Trump administration is just going to try? They're just not doing
that? I'm just saying the deal that Trump is now saying America wants is just nowhere near realistic.
Right, but that's public. We don't know about negotiations behind the scenes, right?
We don't. And some of that supposedly has been ongoing. We don't. It's just so much sheer incompetence, so it's hard to be optimistic. You know, we don't.
Right.
It's been said before, but, Witkoff and Kushner are not accomplished diplomats. We'll see. We'll see. You could wind up with a more stable, peaceful Middle East out of this. But what's hard to imagine is Trump doing that in a way that's not a political loss from him, which he doesn't want to take. That's the problem. Mm-hmm. Is any realistic deal makes it obvious that this war was a stupid idea. He wants a way out that allows him to semi-plausibly say this war wasn't a stupid idea. Donald, it's too late for that. Okay. You can, if you want, get like maybe state collapse, civil war in Iran. Israel would like that. Maybe some Americans would go, okay, I guess that's victory. Maybe. But that's going to tank the global economy, because I think that's going to take minimum another month. And Iran's going to just set the Middle East afire in the meanwhile. So So it won't be judged a political win. In other words, even if people say, okay, you kind of won the war because everybody in Iran's dead now or something, or they're starving. Mm-hmm. And I guess like they're the bad guys. So it's good if they're all either dead or starving and there's no coherent government. I guess kind of you won that. But meanwhile, I'm paying like $11 for gas. So the only way for him to get any number of people to say, I guess you won the war, is for the domestic political cost be completely unacceptable. It seems to me, crazy one things that seem like 1 in 1,000 shots can happen, but I just think they need to accept that they're going to have to take an L here. You know, they're going to have to, Trump can say, no, the war was a good idea, and almost everybody's going to go around saying, no, obviously it wasn't, and he's going to have to live with that. Yeah, or with something that's even worse for him politically. I guess that's what I'd say.
Well, my perception of Trump's general pattern is whatever happens in Iran, he's going to be able to say with the confidence in his voice, like he believes it, that this was a great victory.
Oh, yeah.
And just do something else that is going to take over the head, like invade Cuba or something. There's another thing that you can start so that people move on from the previous big story.
No, it's like, he does it all the time. Like this latest thing Iran's response is below the level of violating the ceasefire somewhere below. It's like, wait, you didn't fire at them. They fired at your naval boats. They fired and hit tankers. And they attacked your fucking ally and blew up their oil facility. I think that's actually constitutes military action. I don't know. I'm not an expert, Donald, but.
Okay, let me give you a little update as well as I can on the Russia-Ukraine situation, more on the Russia side of this, because that's what I understand more and what I hear more about. There is, the segue may be, there's a ceasefire a little bit there. So Putin announced May 8th and 9th is going to be a ceasefire on the Russian side. Mm. And then Zelensky followed with saying we're starting even earlier. The Russian announcement of the ceasefire came with a caveat saying that if Kyiv tries to disrupt the Victory Day celebrations, that's May 9, the Second World War, the Great Patriotic War, as the Soviet part of that war is called. If Kyiv tries to disrupt that, we will attack the center of the Kyiv with the force you haven't seen yet. It's not like, hey, let's move to a peaceful time. But
so he's kind of unilaterally declaring a ceasefire and saying if they violate it, or maybe if they violate it in this particular way, like attacking Russian soil or something, or but in any event, they're saying if they violate the ceasefire, we are declaring we're going to bring hell like they've never seen.
I think they're specifically saying disrupt the Victory Day celebration. So there's going to be a parade, even though for the first time in many years, it doesn't have a heavy military equipment. But like if they do some big attack, like a symbolic gesture, you know, an attack on Moscow, an attack on St. Petersburg, that is going to be noticed. Disrupt this, like the front line is going to, it's not expected for the Ukrainians to stop fighting. Though, again, Zelensky said called something like a regime of silence a few days before the Russian two-day unilateral ceasefire. Mm-hmm. Ukraine is doing that. So this is just a one little point of happening now. I don't think it's really big news. And I think it's probably the ceasefire is probably guided by fear of an attack during the Victory Day celebration, because symbolically that would be really felt by Russians. Mm-hmm. That comes after months of just like, there's not one specific story that like breaks the camel's neck, but there are just like more and more frequent and more effective drone attacks deep within Russia, some of which led, like in Tuapse, they led to an ecological disaster. They had hit the oil refineries and there's oil rain coming down and whatnot. There's just a bunch of stuff internally that doesn't have to do with war, but it, or not like doesn't have to do with war, but not directly really, just economy is getting worse. People are noticing more and more that the prices are changing way too quickly and in one direction. There was this thing that made a lot of noise because it was painful in Siberia. There was an outbreak of some cattle disease. Mm. And it's not even yet clear. Like there's not a good
official...
Are people
claiming it's biological warfare or something?
No, it's just the government didn't communicate very effectively. Like they said, I forget the different kinds of cattle disease, but they named the less scary ones. And their response suggests that it's like foot and mouth disease, I think is what it's called, or some other like really serious one, because they just took people's cattle and culled large numbers without much explanation. And so there was unrest about that. There's, I think where it all comes together in this like sense of things starting to get shaky is the internet shutdowns, because the overall sort of unspoken contract over the last, you know, couple of years was there's no mobilization anymore, right? Like it's not people are being drafted and sent to the war directly. They're relying on the contract military people. And they're saying, you know, you do your, to the people, you keep with your civilian life. The government, the state is going to take care of the war to some extent. There's like, they were trying to keep that separation. But now, with these drones attacks, with airport disruptions, that's just becoming less and less tenable. And the economy, people are starting to connect it more, the prices they see at the grocery store. And then finally, the one place you could go, YouTube, and watch your cooking videos or whatever you're into. Mm-hmm. The internet is getting shut down all across the country. It's not like a one-off switch, like they shut it down completely and there is no internet for the country. But pretty often, for a few days, sometimes I think in Moscow it once lasted like a couple of weeks, the mobile internet barely working. And that's both, you know, distraction and just spending time online looking at your phone, but also paying with your credit card because the terminal for paying is connected to the internet, to the mobile internet. Getting a taxi, just basic amenities of civilian life, which Russians have grown used to. And Russia has been one of the more digitized countries around. Like the government services and everything were pretty effective and like in your phone, and the banking system worked well. And now your phone just doesn't work. And you know, you can't navigate around the city. So all of that contributes to this feeling of maybe they don't have it under control and maybe they're losing control more and more. And that spilled into this, again, kind of weird to tout this as a big news story, but it took over the news cycle for a while. There's this Victoria Bony is her name, Instagram celebrity, not political at all. I'm trying to find a word that's not offensive. Like she's a simple girl. She was a star of a reality TV show, a host of a reality TV show, and likable, but like she's not getting into things that much. But now she's like, you're killing the cattle. The internet's not working. People's businesses that are built on this internet infrastructure are falling apart. She had like four or five of these concerns, and she just went on this rant.
See, I think this might surprise some Americans. I think they imagine a super lockdown media ecosystem. What is she on? She's on Instagram, you said. And is that legal for now?
Instagram has been banned since the very beginning of the war, and yet people are still...
Technically she was censored. It's just that the form of censorship doesn't work.
Yeah, so there are different levels of censorship of the internet, of like them trying to start controlling the internet, and they're getting more effective at it. And this bit, which is like just banning certain platforms, Instagram and Twitter and Facebook, that was like from the first days of the war. YouTube is not banned, but they're, quote, slowing it down, so it just works poorly. But all of that is... you just need to learn how to use VPN and proxy. And that was the main effect of these bans, is more and more Russians, including like 70-year-old grandmas, now know what VPN is and what they need to click on their phone to get to their content. And with Telegram, it's a similar kind of situation. They're banning it, but then kind of letting it go, but then slowing it down. And so there's that. But then there's these shutdowns that just nothing works at all, except they're working on what's called a white list. So they want, they are not there yet. It's like functionally is not always working.
Now, is this the thing where the government wants to have like their own, like Telegram's banned and there's an official government version kind of that you can use instead? And obviously that's inherently a white list if the government controls permissions on who can use it.
That's right. So they want the government services to work. They want people to be able to order a taxi, right? They want the kind of infrastructure part of the internet to be available, but everything else they shut down. So there is no talk. And these shutdowns are difficult to, at least for me, to understand exactly in which instance what was the reason, because there is on the one hand the control of information spread. And on the other hand, these drone attacks are not unconnected to it, using mobile networks to navigate the drones.
Well, yeah. And, you know, Just a quick note. Hezbollah is doing the same thing that both Ukraine and Russia had pioneered, which is to defy attempts to jam the wireless communication that guides a drone. Mm-hmm. They're using these. I don't understand how it works. It's fiber optics that go 10 miles. You can keep it tethered for 10 miles. If I tried that, I don't think it would work. But
there are these pictures. I forget what region it was. It might have been Kherson from pretty early in the war, like the first year or two, I think. Very eerie images where if you look at them and you're not told what this is, you wouldn't understand. It looks like a city is covered in a spider web. It looks like some dystopian sci-fi.
Yeah. Obviously, this is not relevant to these drone strikes that are going very far into Russian territory, but you're saying those are kind of internet infrastructure dependent sometimes, and that's part of the logic behind the shutdown.
Yeah, or at least part of the stated logic.
So it sounds like, is this ceasefire, this little 3-day or whatever it is, ceasefire, do you see that as a sign of weakness? Because it seems, it sounds to me a little bit like the kind of thing Trump would do where, you know, he's not making it that hard for Ukraine to comply with his firm demand. He's like, we're going to have this parade. If you try to disrupt the parade itself, you're in trouble. Mm-hmm. It's like Trump saying, hey, I'm having an honored Trump day. And I'm telling you, if Iran plants a bomb in the men's bathroom at Mar-a-Lago, there's going to be hell to pay, you know? And it's like, well, I don't think that was going to happen anyway. But, it's like, he just seems to be making it, you know, I predict that Ukraine will not try to disrupt the parade. Maybe I'm wrong, but I think, and I kind of think that's one difference between Ukraine and Iran. I think Ukraine wants this war to stop more than Iran does, I think Iran is less afraid of resumption in the wake of a ceasefire than Ukraine would be. But maybe you can tell me, judging by your expression, maybe you're going to tell me that a lot of people are saying, no, Ukraine's actually looking good on the battlefield. That's where I've heard conflicting reports. I mean, it's not like they're... go ahead.
Yeah, on that, you know, I try to keep up. So I end up always with just a general kind of picture. And what the general picture looks like to me now is not a whole lot is not a whole lot of movement is happening on the battlefield, though that is what this part of the year looks like. And it's like right about now in the coming weeks is when it should escalate more because it's springtime moving into summer and the weather conditions are more conducive to a big push. And so both sides are preparing for actions of the other sides and planning their own. And Russia is expected to go on this, an attempt at a big advance. I don't think anybody's doing great on the battlefield itself, like the front line. But there has been this change within Russia, as I'm saying, like these drone attacks are becoming just routine. Like it's, I call people I know in different cities and it's like fucking drones again. And so that is becoming more felt. And then this, I guess the last thing maybe I that is important, I think, for me to bring up is there's now all this talk about, there's always like in the opposition liberal circles from before the war, for decades now, they're always talking about they're hoping for a clash within the elites. Mm-hmm. Like it's what could change things if within the regime there is a split. Mm-hmm. And now, there hasn't been that talk like since Prigozhin when a mutiny was destroyed and it seemed like
and everything was consolidated. He subsequently had an accident. He got in one of those planes that blows up in midair. Happens.
That does happen sometimes. But now people are starting to talk about it more because within the civilian part of the regime, there have been expressed frustration with this internet stuff because it's like one example I just heard recently of, it's like a small example of the logic that the people in charge of like the central bank and stuff like that are worried about and the FSB don't seem to be concerned about. So you shut down the internet. People can't use their cards to pay for their groceries. They want to have cash. They go to the ATMs and take out the cash. Then the banks are freaking out about people taking their cash out and say something like, maybe we should put, you know, impose some limits on how much cash you can take out. That makes people want to take their cash out as much as possible right now. And so from nothing, you know, there was no economic disruption like this with the currency itself, but from this move on the state, on the part of the state to control the internet, you now have an economic cycle of you know, going down. So what is does seem to be happening is the FSB and the FSO and the Siloviki, the that's the term we use, the all kinds of law enforcement and you know, state protection agencies, they do seem to be expanding their domain. Like, they're going to decide that the internet is not going to work in Moscow for 3 weeks. And the civilian...
Whereas previously, who would have decided?
Well, previously, the internet just worked. And nobody thought it was a good idea. Like, that was actually the... It was a big selling point on the part of the Russian state. Like, we're digitizing everything. Like, look at these beautiful government services. You can get whatever government paper you need or book a hospital appointment or whatever. Everything online works beautifully. There's a chatbot you can talk to. Everything is awesome. And now all of that is being is hurting. And like, small businesses that people use, Instagram, Telegram, these are not just for people to talk. There is like a lot of small shops that people are keeping there. And so now all of that is being affected by the decisions by the Siloviki. And that starts a conversation about where does this go in terms of the nature of the regime. Would one of these conflicting sides try to improve their standing with Putin? Or, you know, there's now conversations about a possible coup. All of that is, for my money, you know, I don't see any hard data to suggest we should be talking about possible coup. But the overall, that's why I said like a vibe shift is the way to phrase it. There's not one thing that happened that is now things are different, but there's like a whole spread of these little events that start to feel like a crisis. And it sounds what like the reaction to that crisis is going to be, I don't know.
There's just been a real growth in the domestic political pressure on Putin to find a way to end the war, it sounds like. And that's another thing that kind of surprised some Americans. You know, it's like, wait, I thought he's a dictator who runs everything. What do you mean domestic political pressure? But, you know, autocrats are always, you know, Tom Friedman says nobody does more public opinion polling than an autocrat, you know, because they're insecure, because they are not. Right. They haven't been through the means of legitimization that we're familiar with. They, you know, they may be perceived as legitimate, but they may feel more insecure about their situation. So I guess we'll see. We should probably move on to the cosmic. I mean, just judging by the time, or we can continue talking about this and move toward the cosmic.
Let me throw in just another like a short comment to finish, wrap up that story about the Instagram influencer. Because I think is interesting.
She sounds great.
It is true that...
And maybe she's smarter than you're giving her credit for if she's getting away with this.
I don't want to say anything bad about her. I don't have anything against her. I'm just like, she's not like an oppositional figure. She's not a public commentator. She's not like, it's not her foray. That's not what she's about.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's part of her appeal, actually. Like, she's, and she says, like, I'm, you know, I'm a simple girl. I'm from the people. And I just have this, like, I have to speak from my heart. This is getting bad. And she's not dumb in the way she does this either. She's actually, I think, like, the approach is smart, where she's not attacking Putin. And this is kind of a staple of the Russian political discourse, known as the... Царь хороший, бояре плохие. The czar is good and the boyars are the problem. He just doesn't know everything, or like there are people around him that are causing the trouble. So she's speaking to
Common move of Trumpists, actually. Trump isn't the problem. It's these people around him. It's this, it's that. Yeah.
So she's like appealing to him, like, you know, shit's not working. You got to figure this out. I don't know who you're talking to, but I need to speak to you. And so she managed, because of all that, because she's not the enemy, right, for the regime. She's not one of these people who have been fighting this. She would be happy just keeping her Instagram blog. And she also just has a ton of influence, in terms of followers, who are also not the kind of people who are like spending their time on all of these banned websites reading nasty stories about the regime. So when they start talking, things are not working.
That's why she's dangerous from Putin's point of view.
Yeah. Also, there are like conversations about, well, Russians are always conspiratorial. Maybe that whole thing was a play, because then part of the reason it blew up, she made this rant, and then the government, like pro-war main propagandist, lashed out at her, being very offensive. And it's like, you're talking to a woman like that. So finally, then they meet at a show of his, and he doesn't quite apologize, but there's like a face. So this whole thing is what the reason I'm spending time on this, I think, is it's interesting that this, whether it is, you take the conspiratorial angle and say they decided to kind of put some of the pressure out through a valve, or the pipe burst and suddenly you see this outbreak of frustration where you didn't expect it. Both of these point to the frustration boiling up. There is now there's a conversation about things are not looking that rosy and things starting to fall apart in circles where you didn't hear that before, and in circles that don't want to think about the war or the political prisoners or anything like that. But now it's all of these frustrations, from the culling of the cattle to the prices of groceries, to the war, to ecology, to the political situation at home, like who's in charge here, who's in control of the situation, all of that is coming to the surface as one generalized frustration with the direction of the country.
It sounds to me like there's some genuine pipe bursting, but I'm not an expert. So we should go into overtime. Which is available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter. Link in the show notes, or go to nonzero.org and find this post, and you can sign up there. Set up your podcast feed so that you always get the overtimes where we, you know, things get zanier and spicier and closer to cancel-worthy, frankly. Yeah, weirder. So, But I'm going to give you 1 minute before we go, because I have to go get coffee, to remind people of where they can find your stuff again. I mean, I mentioned some of the stuff, but I didn't mention what you call KP. I didn't mention your Twitter handle. I didn't mention exactly what you're up to at Psychopolitico. So while I go get my coffee, why don't you remind people, and then we'll go into overtime the moment I get back. So you better use your time wisely.
Sound good. Okay,
right.
That's actually a kind of an appropriate timing, because I think today, or worst case tomorrow, I'll finally start publishing things. So I've been going on streams every couple of weeks with Boris Shashetishvili, who's been on the show. Bob and me and Boris have talked. He's a I call him planetary scholar. I think it's an emergent definition. So he's working on ideas about the planet as a whole, looking at historical ways of looking at the planet as such, from geosciences and spiritual traditions and whatnot, to today, AI or not AI, the overall technology encompassing the planet in an envelope of the technosphere and the noosphere, and the globalized community and all that. So he's a regular conversation partner. We talk every couple of weeks, and we've been streaming this at psychopolitica.substack.com, but not publishing these conversations. And now I finally figured out some of the framing for it that will make it easier. And I'm working on an episode from this past week right now, and I'm going to publish it today or tomorrow. I'm going to see if I can share a screen real quick. Oh, and Bob said KP, that means Cosmopolitica. That is the part of Psychopolitica where I'm talking to Boris. So psychopolitica.substack.com is where you get that. And I'll just quickly, while Bob is putting his headphones in, show this, which is my new interface for both organizing the conversations that Boris and I are having, and then turning that into a more of a map of ideas that Psychopolitica more broadly deals with. And Bob is back.
I'm back. Time's up. But yeah, sign up for all of Nikita's endeavors. okay, so we're going into overtime.